to say, we are beginning this morning on page 191, and I'm going to try, believe it or not, take on two entire chapters this morning, and this because they're both big chapters, but they're on the same subject. And I'm afraid that too often we have a tendency, seeing a whole lot of material in each chapter, to think of them as being distinct, and they're really not. So I thought today that since we've already covered this material on Wednesday night just recently in our study of the chronological Bible, that we'd go ahead and just hit highlights tonight and try to keep the two chapters together. I especially recommend that you grab a pencil or a pen here this morning as we'll try to get some notes into your Bibles there. And I'm also wanting to try and touch on just a thing or two that we have not touched on the Wednesday night class. So we're trying to do a couple of things here this morning, keep the two chapters together, give you some notes as well, and then sort of link up with the material we've already studied. So let's just plow in here on page 191 with Matthew chapter 23. You'll see that Mark 12 and Luke 20 are both parallels, although by far Matthew's account is significantly longer. So if you turn quickly just to look at page 192, you see a lot of blank space there in those two columns for Mark and Luke, but Matthew has the more complete account. So Jesus spoke to the multitudes and to his disciples, saying, "The scribes and the Pharisees have seated themselves in the chair of Moses." Now, just so you know, in the synagogues, there was a carved rock that had been shaped into the form of a stool, and a comfortable one, but still a carved rock, that was called Moses' seat. And the teachers would use that when they were teaching. So it's not just a symbolic or figurative expression about trying to have the authority of Moses, though it's referencing that, because when they sat in that seat, that was the idea there, but it was actually a physical chair of Moses. Verse 3, "Therefore, all that they tell you, do and observe, but do not do according to their deeds, for they say and do not do. They tie up heavy loads and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are unwilling to move them with so much as a finger. But they do all their deeds to be noticed by men, for they broaden their phylacteries and lengthen the tassels of their garments. They love the place of honor at banquets and chief seats in the synagogues and respectful greetings in the marketplaces and being called by men rabbi, but do not be called rabbi, for one is your teacher," rabbi of course being the Hebrew word for teacher, but taking it as a title, "for you are all brothers." Page 192, Matthew 23:9, "And do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father who is in heaven. Do not be called leaders, for one is your leader, that is Christ. But the greatest among you shall be your servant, and whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted, and then will come the woe unto you." So Jesus has already been giving counsel with regard to the scribes and Pharisees that they're out of line. And in this case, he is needling them, if you will, and exposing them for their arrogance, for their pride, for their desire to have all kinds of special titles and deference paid to them wherever they go. Jesus summarizes all of that in verses 11 and 12, that the servant spirit is that spirit which he, and which God therefore, is trying to produce in all people. But it's all about the beginning of Matthew 23, the failure of the scribes, the Pharisees, the lawyers, all of the religious leaders of the time. Now, you will know from our previous studies that we have been told that Jesus is going into the temple area every day. And then he comes back and over or around the Mount of Olives to get to Bethany, where he spends the night with Mary and Martha and Lazarus. So it doesn't say specifically here, although at the end of Matthew 23's material, not recorded by Matthew, we'll find it in Mark. In Mark and Luke. He certainly is in the temple on this occasion because he sees a woman who's putting money into the treasury. So the location is the temple area, not inside the holy place itself, but they're immediately adjacent, the courtyards. He is criticizing the men who are most responsible for those courtyards, And he's already overturned the money changers' carts and all of that. He has spent several days telling these people that their religious leaders are utter failures. Now, here's your first note. If you look down at verse 14, skip 13 for a minute, you'll see that it's in brackets. Matthew has the statement, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you devour widows' houses, even while for a pretense you make long prayers, therefore you shall receive greater condemnation." That verse is in brackets. There are some older manuscripts that don't have that verse. But what do you note about the column with Mark and Luke? It does. It references that same material. So I rather think that probably this 14th verse was in Matthew's Gospel. Some of the manuscripts have, for some reason, you know, lost it, but I think it belongs there. However, they are often referred to in Matthew 23 as the seven woes. The seven woes. But you'll note in your numbering, there's only seven if you don't count verse 14. And I would. So I rather think there are eight woes. Doesn't make any big difference. But actually, there will be eight separate statements that begin with what verse 13 introduces. "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you shut off the kingdom of heaven from men, for you do not enter in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you devour widows' houses, even while for a pretense you make long prayers, therefore you shall receive greater condemnation. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you travel about on sea and land to make one proselyte, and when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of..." New American Standard has hell. What's the Greek word? Gehenna refers to the valley of Hinnom, but that's what that is, as yourselves. I hope. Yeah, Gehenna there. Okay, so now, at the top of page 16 on 193, "Woe to you blind guides who say, whoever swears by the temple, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he's obligated. You fools and blind men. Which is more important, the gold or the temple that sanctified the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the offering upon it, he is obligated. You blind men. Which is more important, the offering or the altar that sanctifies the offering? Therefore, he who swears, swears by both the altar and by everything on it. And he who swears by the temple, swears by the temple and by him who dwells within it. And he who swears by heaven, swears by both the throne of God and by him who sits upon it." Verse 23, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected the weightier provisions of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. But these are the things you should have done without neglecting the others. You blind guides who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you clean the outside of the cup and of the dish, but inside they're full of robbery and self-indulgence. You blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and of the dish, so that the outside of it may become clean also. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which on the outside appear beautiful, but inside they're full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Even so, you too outwardly appear righteous to men, but inwardly you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous, and say if we'd been living in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partners with them in shedding the blood of the prophets. Consequently, you bear witness against yourselves that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up, then, the measure of the guilt of your fathers, you serpents, you brood of vipers. How shall you escape the sentence of Gehenna? Therefore, behold, I am sending you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify. Some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that upon you may fall all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Truly I say to you, all these things shall come upon this generation. Top of 194, verse 37, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together, the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were unwilling. Behold, your house is being left to you desolate, for I say to you, from now on, you shall not see me until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And what's that? The end of Matthew 23. Now, turn back to 193 again, and here's where you're going to want to get your pencil out. Depending on your numbering, if you like, you can number these woes with, on page 192 actually, verse 13 is number 1, verse 14 is number 2, verse 15 is number 3, verse 16 is number 4, verse 23 is 5, verse 25 is 6, verse 27 is 7, and verse 29 is number 8. How does Jesus feel about the scribes and the Pharisees? Not very pleased. Woe be unto you. He can't find a good word to say about them. Who is the subject of chapter 23? The scribes and the Pharisees. Now then, in verse 34 through 36, my book, I used a red felt tip pen to put a big star next to those three verses. Behold, I am sending you prophets and wise men and scribes. Let me ask you a question. Is Jesus sending prophets to anybody these days? No. Now, there may be wise men and scribes, but who's leading the list here? The prophets. Some of them you'll kill and crucify. You know any place on earth where crucifixion's still taking place? Some of them you'll scourge in your synagogues. When's the last time you heard about such a thing? Persecuted from city to city, that upon you. Now, throughout this chapter, who's the you? The scribes and the Pharisees. You may fall all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. By the way, that's a different Zechariah than the prophet. Apparently, one has just been murdered very recently. And then Jesus gives us the first time reference. And that's what makes this passage so important. Who is guilty of all the righteous blood shed on earth from Abel in Genesis 4 to this Zechariah that they had just killed? Those scribes and Pharisees. And how many of these things that Jesus is talking about as he says, woe unto you, are going to take place 2,000 years from now? Nothing he's talking about is 2,000 years in the future. It'll come upon this generation. Now, as you know from our Revelation study, and as you know likely also from our recent chronological Bible study, brother, so far as I know, there's never been a Bible commentator who has ever had a disagreement with any other Bible student on what verse 36 means. What does verse 36 mean when it says, all these things shall come upon this generation? What does generation mean? It means the people who are currently breathing in and out and pumping blood and giving Jesus all kinds of grief. It means them. Now then, generation in that phrase, universally understood to refer to the then living people who are listening with their physical ears to what Jesus is saying. Can anybody tell me why I'm making such a big point out of that right now? Because we're going to have the identical expression 34 verses from now in the next chapter. And there, the majority of denominational people will then turn this upside down and say it doesn't mean that at all when it is identical in an uninterrupted context used twice, then a two drastically different things about it. Bill, you have to be really fast. You know, no, I don't know, and they were ultimately anyway. For all I know at this point, you remember that the Sadducees had really been run out of town with their ploy about the man, the woman that had been married seven times, didn't dare ask him a question anymore. It's probably just that at this moment they're not there, and Jesus is addressing the people who are present. I'm thinking that's really all it is. And nothing larger than that. The brethren, somehow, you know, you really want to mark and remember that 36th verse and what goes before it, that all the righteous blood is going to be held against a single generation. It is that generation, and everybody knows this is the fall of Jerusalem at that location. Now, when you turn the page, they've separated it, and it's kind of helpful in this case. You need another big red star for verse 37. Because now that we've had a time reference for the judgments that are being discussed in this sentence of Gehenna that they cannot escape, the location of that is also given in verse 37. Jerusalem. Jerusalem. Why? They kill the prophets. They stone those that are sent to her. He just said so in the preceding verses. And another element of the punishment is listed in verse 38. Your house is being left to you desolate. Somebody quickly, or one at a time, what are the two ways that house can be understood in Scripture? This house that he's talking about could refer to what? The Jews, the house of Israel, or what's the other? The temple, the house of God. In this case, both are true. So it doesn't, you don't even need the distinction. Both of those things are going to be desolated. They're going to be destroyed. There will be a desolation that's going to take place before you ever get to chapter 24. Desolation is being preached by Jesus against Jerusalem in that generation because of the scribes and Pharisees' hypocrisy. Now, you all know the story of the widow's mite. So on page 194, Mark and Luke tell us, Matthew and John do not, but in Mark 12, he sat down opposite the treasury, began observing how the multitude were putting money into the treasury. Many rich people were putting in large sums. Poor widow came, put in two small copper coins, which amount to a cent. Calling his disciples to him, he said to them, truly I say to you, this poor widow put in more than all the contributors to the treasury. For they all put in out of their surplus. She, out of her poverty, put in all she owned, all she had to live on. So she is set in contrast against these horrible hypocrites who have abandoned all spiritual thought and righteousness. They're immoral, but they're in it for the money and the prestige, and Jesus has excoriated them at length throughout an entire chapter, and then points at this woman as the perfect polar opposite. Now, again, highlighting, please note at the bottom of the page, brethren, because in virtually every Bible that's out there today, and in every pulpit in America, when we come to this material, denominational people start setting the stage in this manner. Matthew 23:37. At the bottom of the page, first footnote, Jesus' deep concern for Jerusalem was voiced in similar language about 3 months earlier in Luke 13, also 2 days before, in somewhat different language, in Luke 19. This city represented the whole nation of Israel for whom Jesus was deeply burdened, especially in light of her coming judgment. Now, I just want to add there, first, get your pencil, put at the end of that paragraph, after judgment, just write, also, pages 140 and 141 and 162 also. I won't give you the scriptural references because you haven't got much room to write there, but if you'll add, also pages 140, 141, and 162, so that you'll be reminded this topic is coming up very frequently in the preaching of Jesus, more frequently than any one gospel writer tells you. And so when you put all of those together, it is just striking how much Jesus has been saying about this judgment, when it will happen, and where it will take place. But now, in the next paragraph, Matthew 23:39, at his second coming, now stop. As soon as you say second coming in all the world, do people think that's happened yet or not? Not. The title has come to be universally and exclusively associated with what? Future global universal judgment. So they say at his second coming, a far greater proportion of Israel will joyfully recognize Jesus as Messiah than did so at his first coming. This lament over Jerusalem was preparatory to what Jesus wanted to tell his disciples about his future coming and its relation to Jerusalem. Now, brethren, that's right. That's exactly what Jesus is doing. He's talking about his future coming and its relation to Jerusalem. In what generation? In that generation. So, he came, he lived out his life, he spent 3.5 years preaching, he died, he was raised, and he will return to heaven 40 days later. Now, this paragraph, though, suggests the idea that a far greater proportion of Israel will joyfully recognize Jesus as Messiah than did so at his first coming. Is that sentence true in the same generation that he's blistering right now? Jews aren't going to come to Christ. And the Jews are not going to come wholesale to Christ at the end of planet Earth either. That is one of the foundation tenets of premillennialism. The kingdom has not yet been created. The kingdom won't be created till we come to the millennium, which is a myth. But that when that happens, the entire Jewish nation, they teach, is going to accept Christ. Now, they haven't done it yet, any day now, but not yet. Okay, that is pure fiction. So they're trying to set the stage, though, with the footnote that you should expect Jesus to be using this material in Matthew 24 in two totally different ways. Part of it will deal with Jerusalem. Part of it will deal with the end of the world. Part of it will be in this generation. Part of it hasn't happened yet 2,000 years later, but any day now, you know, they keep teaching. No such thing happens in this context. So when you turn the page to page 195, and we start in using Matthew as the main text, because again, if you'll turn the next couple of pages, you'll note that Matthew's is the fuller account. So let's go to Matthew 24:1. Jesus came out from the temple. So where did he been? Not in the building itself, but immediately in the courtyards around it. He was going away when his disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. He had just said in verse 38, their house would be left desolate. He had said that in the courtyards of the house. It was yards away. This impresses his disciples. So, as they're leaving, they point at what? The temple buildings. He answered in verse 2 and said to them, do you not what? See what? All what? These things. Truly I say to you, not one what? Stone where? Here shall be left upon another which will not be torn down. Who's talking about the end of the world here? Not a soul. And as he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, so they made it across the Kidron over to the other side, came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things be? These things, pronoun. It's an expression that refers back to what we've been talking about. A desolate house in this generation in the city of Jerusalem because of the rejection of these religious leaders of Jesus the Christ. And in that generation, not one stone's going to be left upon another in the house that's being left desolate. The apostles want to know, how many questions? Okay, you all have been through this material with me. Look at the bottom of the page. at the footnote. The disciples apparently asked what? No, they didn't. They only asked two. We'll see that in a minute. The first pertains, reading, continuing in the footnote, to the destruction of the temple, which subsequently happened in AD 70 at the hands of the Roman army. Indeed, that's certainly correct. Another pertained to Jesus' future personal return and the consummation of the age associated with it. Though separated by many years, the two events are closely related in that both are part of God's ongoing program for the people of Israel. The other question related to the sign when these things, probably the destruction of the temple, were about to happen. The disciples assumed that the destruction of the temple would be the prelude to Messiah's return to consummate the age and initiate his kingdom on earth. As a matter of fact, that's because it's just what Jesus has been telling them. Jesus did not deny a relationship between the two events, nor did he in the subsequent discourse reveal the long interval that would separate the two. Well, amen to that. Jesus never said a thing in the world about a long interval. He never said a thing in the world about anything other than the fall of Jerusalem, and they know it. So it's very frustrating, brethren, that when you're dealing with our modern scribes and Pharisees, they're just as hypocritical. Endlessly, they will admit that the passage doesn't teach what they believe, but they want it to teach that. So they have to twist and abuse and misuse this passage, and thus they do, as you see in this paragraph. Now it says, I'm going to read that again. Jesus did not deny a relationship between the two events, nor did he in the subsequent discourse reveal the long interval that would separate the two. Some predictions were fulfilled a few years after he spoke the words, but others have as yet to be fulfilled. Brethren, there's not a word of Scripture to support that last phrase. Premillennialism says that as yet, some of this material has not yet been fulfilled. Jesus never said that. The apostles didn't think that. There's no verse anywhere to support that. That is pure premillennial doctrine. We need a 2,000-year gap minimum, because it hasn't happened yet. Then we need the Jesus to return physically. Then we need for him to set up a kingdom which they deny has been here for 2,000 years. We need the physical temple to be rebuilt. We need 1,000 physical years of Jesus to reign on earth in his body again at Jerusalem. And then the rest of Matthew 24 is going to be fulfilled. Brethren, that is just horrifically unsustainable. There's no reason to believe such things. But see how they put it on the page, as Darby's Bible did and so many others, for so long. So, look at Mark's column in verse 4 and ask yourself, how many questions did the apostles ask? Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign when all these things are going to be fulfilled? They've been told that all these things will be fulfilled in this generation. They just want to know when, more specifically, and what will be the sign? There are only two interrogatives. When and what? There are only two questions. There's not a hint of a third question about the end of planet Earth in Mark's Gospel. Look at Luke, verse 7. They question him, saying, Teacher, when therefore, will these things be? And what will be the sign when these things are about to take place? Again, only two questions. Again, twice repeated, these things, the only things that they've been talking about, the things they're pointing at, the stones that won't be left one upon another, the house that's going to be desolate in Jerusalem in this generation, because Jesus spent a whole chapter saying that the Pharisees have failed to serve their God and will not accept their Messiah. So, tremendously important, brethren, don't let people get away with this third question thing. In Matthew, there are only two interrogatives. When will these things be, and what will be the sign, singular, the sign, one sign, of your coming and of the end of the age? There is one sign that is for the coming of Jesus and the end of the age. Only that one second question, not a third. Now, we turn the page to 196. In Matthew 24, verse 4. Now, through verse 14, and you might, through verse 14, you have all the things that will not be, what the sign will not be. Jesus answered and said to them, "See to it that no one misleads you. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will mislead many. And you will be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not frightened, for those things must take place, but that is not yet the end of the age that they asked about." And then at verse 7, "Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, in various places there will be famines and earthquakes. All these things are merely the beginning of birth pains. Then they will deliver you to tribulation, they will kill you, and you'll be hated by all nations on account of my name. And at that time, many will fall away, and will deliver up one another, and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise, and will mislead many. And because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end of the age they asked about, the age of Solomon's temple, the age of Moses' law, the end of Jerusalem, the end of that age in their generation, the one who endures to that end shall be saved." Now verse 14, big red star. "And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world for a witness to all the nations, and then the end shall come." Now he answers the when question. The end of the age will come when this gospel is preached in all the nations. So no doubt, even growing up in America, your mailbox has been filled for decades with denominational churches saying, "Send me your money, we'll preach the gospel in some remote part of the world, because if we do that, we can get Jesus to come back for the second coming and blow up planet Earth or set up a millennial kingdom," depending on their particular, you know, end times philosophy. Now, brethren, the gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world for a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. Write down, there's plenty of room next to that verse 14 in Mark's column. You've got a nice, handy, blank space there. I'm going to give you four passages of Scripture. Romans chapter 1, verse 8. Romans 1, 8. And also chapter 10, verse 18 in the Roman letter. Romans 1, 8 and Romans 10, 18. Then below that, you write Colossians 1, verse 6, comma 23, verses 6 and 23. And then, in Acts 2, verses 5 through 11, you'll have a list of various nations and languages that the gospel was being translated into, who are the very people that are involved right here. Now, I'm just going to read one of these passages for you right now. You won't need to turn, but I'm looking at verse 18. In verse 18 of Romans chapter 10, "I say, surely they've never heard, have they? Indeed they have. Their voice has gone out into all the earth," that's the word gaze, we'll talk about that in a minute, "and their words to the end of the world," and that word is oikoumenes, which is the identical word for world in Matthew 24:14. The Roman letter was written in 57 A.D. In 57 A.D., the end would come when the gospel was preached to the entire oikoumene. In 57 A.D., Romans 10:18 says, "That's been done." That's been done. So what are we expecting? We're expecting then the end will come. Not 2,000 years later, but sometime soon. Colossians was written in 62 A.D., 5 years later. 62 A.D. is about 4 years before the Romans will invade and then eventually destroy Jerusalem in 70 A.D. In 62 A.D., just 4 years before the Roman armies marched in to begin the siege, it also says twice in the first chapter that the gospel's been preached in all the world. What should we be expecting then? The end of the what? The age that they asked about, where not one stone will be left upon another in this city of Jerusalem, the house will be left desolate before the generation ends. Now then, you go down to Matthew 24:15, and after these first verses where he tells you what the sign is not, I should have said verse 13, in verse 14 he tells you when the end shall come, so shortly after 62 AD, and then in verse 15 he tells you what the sign is. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, the house was going to be left what? When the abomination comes to do it, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, Jerusalem and or the Temple Mount in the center of it. Let the reader understand. Now turn the page to verse 16. When you see the abomination of desolation, when you see it in your generation, in this city of Jerusalem, then, verse 16, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to get the things out that are in his house. Let him who is in the field not turn back to get his cloak. Woe to those who are with child, to those who nurse babes in those days. But pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on a Sabbath. For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall. And unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Now, brethren, thus upon the same, you've heard it a dozen times from me, this is an escapable judgment. If you don't want this abomination of desolation to come down on you, if you don't want to be there when all the stones of the temple are raining down out of the sky, if you don't want to be there at the end of that age, which is going to amount to a tremendous amount of bloodshed and destruction, then what you need to do is get out of town. Go to the Judean hills. Run fast as you can. Hope it's not in the winter. Hope you're not carrying a child. And then the days will be cut short so that life can be saved. It's an escapable physical judgment. Can you escape the end of the world in the final judgment? Absolutely not. No run into a Judean hill is going to do anything for you. So there's not one word anywhere, brethren, about some future thing 2,000 years ahead. There's a whole lot about a future thing in this generation and in Jerusalem that they would experience. So then, as you look on the bottom of page 197, Matthew says, when you see the abomination of desolation which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then flee. Look at Luke's column on the top of page 198. Luke put it this way. When you see planet Earth got caught up in my premillennialism again, didn't I? No, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by what? Then recognize that her what is at hand? Desolation. The abomination of desolation is the Roman armies surrounding Jerusalem. Now, the history of this is utterly fascinating. I've just bought yet another copy of Josephus this last week. I'm stacking those things up taller than I am. But I got another one. It comes replete with more maps and all of this, you know. It's a fabulous thing. But, brethren, you know, this invasion is well known. It was documented by an eyewitness. It is meticulously recorded. Rome came. And then inexplicably withdrew. And by the thousands, there were Jews who fled the city for the Judean hills, a place called Pella. And in so doing, were not killed. Their lives were saved. And then Rome, very shortly later, enclosed the city again, and there was no escaping now. This was physically fulfilled in that generation, at the city of Jerusalem, which is named more than once, when the Romans came to desolate the city and the temple both, so that not one stone was left upon another in the temple that the apostles were pointing at, the only thing they were asking about. This brings us then to verse 23 of Matthew 24 in the left-hand very bottom of 198, which we can read very rapidly. If anyone says to you, behold, here is the Christ, or there he is, don't believe him. For false prophets, Christ and false prophets will arise, will show great signs and wonders, so as mislead, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I've told you in advance. If therefore they say to you, behold, he's in the wilderness, don't go forth. Or behold, he's in the inner rooms, do not believe him. For just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. And brother, when he says it's, you know, it's like lightning, it just means you can't miss it. You always notice it. It won't be something somebody needs to drag you out in the wilderness to have a look at. Everybody's going to know. Everybody's going to know because Rome is the abomination of desolation, and they're going to surround the whole city, and you need to run for your life. So nobody's going to miss that, and they didn't. And then it says, wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Vultures is better. Carrion bird is better. Eagle is really not quite correct. Lots of people think that this is the standards, those banners that the Romans, you know, had every legion identified with. In fact, they did have eagles on them. They loved to refer to their eagles. They used eagles a lot. But the word here is not eagle. It's vulture. It's carrion bird. And I'm not at all convinced that in this case, in verse 28, really, what we're talking about is the Roman army. We were talking about the Roman army back in the preceding verses, but since verse 23 and all the way down, you know, to this verse, we're talking about false prophets now. And I think they're the vultures that were feeding on the corpse of Israel and Jerusalem. I think it's where the false prophets are, and the vultures are them, that you'll recognize this is where then the desolation is going to take place. And again, first century eyewitnesses record their false prophets just crawling all over the city at that time. Now then, immediately after the tribulation of those days, so immediately after the days when you guys flee the city to get out so your life can be saved, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall and from the sky, the powers of the heavens will be shaken, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory, and he will send forth his angels, which I take to be the apostles and Christians, with a great trumpet. They'll gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. That is a reference to the spread of the gospel and people coming out of the world to become Christians. Now, the part I want to give you in my last 4 minutes here that I haven't done before is with regard to the word that's the last word in Matthew's column on page 199, earth. Grab your pencil. Next to that, you got a nice long line there above the footnote, you know, and two blank columns to write in. Put in put in quotation marks first, right after the word earth, land, L-A-N-D, and then underline it. And then put land in Matthew 2:6. Now we're all in Matthew 2, so you put Matthew 2:6, then you just put comma 20, comma 21, and then Matthew 4:15, 4:15 in Matthew and elsewhere. Now I'm going to go back while you're writing to Matthew, and this word gate that I told you about a moment ago is translated the very same word that is gates, translated earth, in Matthew 24. The identical word is used also in Matthew's gospel by the same author in verse 6 when he quotes and says, and you, Bethlehem, land of Judah, are by no means least among the leaders of Judah, for out of you shall come forth a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. It'd be pretty weird to translate that, and you, Bethlehem, earth of Judah. Earth isn't right. It makes a mistake there. In chapter 2 as well, I'll get to 2 Carl, at verse 20, it says this, arise and take the child, his mother, and go into the earth of Israel. No, it's the same word, gates. The land is what it says in the text. The land of Israel. In verse 21, he rose and took the child and his mother and came into the very same word in Matthew's later 24th chapter. Well, it's not translated earth in Matthew 2:21. It's translated land of Israel. And in Matthew 4:15, the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, by the way, the sea beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. Firstly, everywhere else, brethren, it's not translated earth, it's translated land. And it's talking about the land of Israel and the tribal lands that comprise the land of Israel. Well, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in verse 30, and then all the tribes of the land. Brethren, if you've ever read the Old Testament, I'm thinking a few of these Jews have, what are the tribes of the land? And the 12 tribes of Israel. That's the only land that we're talking about. And then we'll close with the bottom of page 200. And this is fine. I didn't quite make it, but I got real close. Matthew 24, verses 33 and 34. Even so, you too, when you see all these things, recognize he's near, right at the door. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. It is identical to the end of Matthew 23. There has been no change in the topic. It has been an uninterrupted explanation of when the end of the Jewish age, the temple age, the Moses age, Mosaic age, will take place. Okay? So we'll stop there. In other words, the end in that generation of Jerusalem left desolate and a temple, not one stone left on another, that they were pointing at. Thank you.